look at the minutes? Thank you. Thank you for moving them for approval. For those minutes are for our last meeting on Thursday, January 11th. Okay, members, we don't have a quorum yet, so I guess we can't approve the minutes just yet. We'll come back to you, Representative Bly. So if the members can look over the minutes, and we'll wait for a quorum on that.
Yeah.
Thank you for a good first meeting. This, of course, is our second meeting of the session so far. Last time we had you all do your introductions, so I very much appreciate that, hearing your backgrounds and what your interests are, and also where you lived when you were 3 years old was very helpful and interesting for the committee. Also being updated about the basics of the four programs that come through the Department of Education, ECFE, Head Start, and all of those programs gave us about half a picture of what this committee does. Now we're going to look at the half that the Department of Human Services does. And so we have several members from the staff here to present for an overview of the Department of Human Services. First, I think, will be Chuck Johnson, who is the Assistant Commissioner for Children's and Family. We're also going to hear from Sheree Kotelnik, who's the Manager of Child Care Assistance Programs, and Deb Swenson-Klatt, the Manager of Early Childhood Development. I think Deb is actually going second, and then we have a provider here. We thought last time it was good to have the overviews from the department, but we'd actually try to have someone that's out in the field working on these programs. And members, we are hoping to work in your questions more today. Just a note, we are on TV today, so you have these people around the state of Minnesota watching. So I know you're always on your best behavior, but today would be a good day to watch what we say and do as we're presenting the best side of the legislature here. Now we do have a quorum, so Representative Bly. Okay, thank you. Representative Bly moves approval of the minutes for January 11th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for January 11th are approved. Well, for our first piece of business, we have Chuck Johnson here, who's the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Families, right, with the Department of Human Services. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services with the Department of Human Services. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today and to discuss with you the programs that the Department of Human Services operates in the early childhood area. These are our child care programs, and the bulk of the presentation we get today will be from Deb Swenson-Klatt and Sheree Kotelnik, who are the managers who oversee those programs for us. I'd just like to give you a little introduction, sort of set a context for the programs and for those programs within DHS. Within DHS, the child care programs fit in the Children and Family Services area. That's along with our economic assistance programs such as MPIP and food stamps and so forth. Also with child welfare, which includes child protection and foster care and those pieces of our work. Child support enforcement, our homelessness efforts, refugee services, and a number of other services that we oversee within this part of the department. The core of what we do in CFS and Children and Family Services is really around the most disadvantaged kids in Minnesota and trying to improve their lives through the services that we provide. These are families from very low incomes, children with disabilities, or children who are suffering from abuse and neglect. So it's really some of the kids in our society who we're most trying to provide assistance to, really need the help of the services we provide in order to succeed later in life. And of course, this is very closely connected with what we're trying to do in our child care programs as well, is to really focus on those kids who are most in need, particularly those from low-income families, those from immigrant groups, and so forth. I think it's also consistent with overall the discussions that have happened over the last several years in the early childhood discussions within Minnesota, which is really about how we can target the efforts in our early childhood areas, particularly to help those kids who are not going to be ready for kindergarten, which we know are disproportionately kids from low-income families, kids from families with other disadvantages in terms of the resources the parent can bring to help that child in learning. And so I think in that way we're really on the same page, and having child care programs within this part of DHS I think gives us some synergy around those issues and around those kids. And it's really about not talking just about the silos that we're in, the early childhood silo or the child welfare silo or whichever, but those children who are at risk and those risks that cross multiple of those silos. And we all know that getting the kids ready for school, the focus of this committee, is not just about giving them an early learning opportunity when they're 3 or 4 years old. That's part of what they need. But if that child's been abused or neglected when they're 2 years old, there need to be services there to support that child, to support that family, to put that kid in a position where they can actually benefit from those services when they're 3 or 4. So those pieces really do need to work together, particularly for these kids who have a range of problems that cross all the multiple silos. And that's what we're trying to do, both at a policy level and a service level, is to try to coordinate those pieces together to target particularly those kids who are most in need. And I appreciate that that's something that this committee is going to be focusing on as well through work in early childhood. The DHS's role in child care, the state's role in child care, really does need to be understood as a role within the context of a private market. The child care market is a private market in which parents are out finding care for their kids, sometimes buying it, sometimes bartering for it, sometimes getting it from a relative without any cost. Multiple ways that happens. So Deb Swenson-Klatt will describe some of the research we have on how parents find and arrange for child care. But it is a private market in which we have a role to try to help make that market function, and particularly we hope to try to help those kids that I was just talking about. Deb and Sheree will talk about particular aspects of this, but I'll give you the three sort of pieces that we do that are really important in this. One is that we provide information to parents. Those are the purchasers of care. Those are the ones who are usually making the decision about where they're going to go for care. And that's a piece of our work that we do largely through the Child Care Resource and Referral Network. We provide assistance to providers, and this is both in terms of helping them develop or get licensed or do other things in terms of their capacity, but also in terms of professional development and training. And that's a piece of our work that we do to try to help on the supply side to develop a higher quality of care in the overall market. And then finally, of course, we subsidize child care for low-income families, and that's a piece that Sheree Pilnick will talk with you about in a few moments. That is, the purpose there is really a dual function. This is partly to support low-income parents when they're going to work, to give them the ability to go to work so they have a safe place to leave their children, where they can trust their children. But it's also an opportunity to move those children into a setting where they can get some early learning benefit while their parent is working, which can also then help get them ready for school and ready for later life. So it's really about how we bring those pieces together and how we interact with the parents who are buying the care, the providers who are providing the care in that market, and how we can add value so that we can see the monies, particularly those monies through our child care assistance program, create the best value for the state and for the individual families who we're serving. And so when Deb Swenson-Klatt comes down, she'll start by talking to you about the child care market and what we know about that market, and then she and Sheree move in to talk about the services we provide. And I hope as they're doing that, you can think about how we look at what we can do to improve the way that we interact with that market. Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Deb Swenson-Klatt to come down if there are no questions for me.
Okay, thank you. We're going to try to get some questions. Are there any question or two for Assistant Commissioner Johnson? Okay. Well, next we'll have Deb Swenson-Klatt, who will be talking about early childhood developments, and I know quality within that. And members, as you know, we're focusing on closing the achievement gap, which many of us heard this morning in the E-12 committee. We had testimony on that. And one of our big focuses is on quality, and I know that that's the area that Deb Swenson-Klatt works in. She'll be presenting, we think, for about 20 minutes, and then we'll take a few questions and then move into having Katie Williams, who is from the YWCA. Welcome to the committee, if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Deb Swenson-Klatt. I'm the Director of Child Development Services at the Department of Human Services. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today to give you a program overview of the Child Care Quality Program at DHS. As Chuck mentioned, I'm going to speak a little bit about the child care market, believing that that kind of context will be helpful for you in understanding how our programs interact with and support child care providers throughout the state, as well as the families who use them. We have provided a folder for each of you, a blue folder, and both Sheree and I will be referring to materials in that folder. And included in those is a PowerPoint handout so that you can follow along with our presentation. We really would like to highlight both some of the similarities of child care programs throughout the state, as well as some of the differences between child care settings, which are privately owned and operate in a private market, compared to the early education programs that you heard about from the Department of Education last Thursday. Just a brief description of what excuse me, I went too far there. Brief description of what child care is. This may seem very elementary, but we want to make sure that there's a common definition of child care, which is both care and education for children while parents work or attend school. There are in Minnesota approximately 300,000 children who need some kind of child care while their parents are working. And we typically talk about four types of child care when we are looking at the providers that we work with. Two of those types of providers are licensed child care settings, child care centers, which include both full-day child care programs and part-day private preschool programs. Licensed family child care homes are another type of licensed setting and are is a form of care that takes place in a child care provider's home for care for up to 14 children at maximum. In child care centers, those programs can serve children up through age 12 if they want to. And in family child care homes, care can be provided for children up through age 10. We also work with school-age care programs in Minnesota, and these programs are not licensed if they're offered, as most are, through school districts. And this is typically before and after school care, but also summertime care and care that occurs over holidays and other school breaks. And, of course, is offered to kindergarten, typically up through fifth or sixth grade. And finally, we have a type of care that we're is commonly being referred to now as family, friends, and neighbor care, or FFN care in Minnesota. And this is legal and licensed care that can take place in the home of the child or the provider. And a provider is allowed to take care of children from one unrelated family in addition to their own children or other relatives' children without receiving a license. So just delving into the types of licensed care a little bit more, the majority of licensed child care settings in Minnesota are in family child care homes. There are almost 12,000 family child care providers currently licensed in the state. And then over just over 2,000 licensed center-based settings. And in that category of center-based settings, I do include full-day centers as well as private preschool programs and school-age programs are tossed in there too, even though, as I just mentioned, they aren't licensed. But sometimes when we refer to center-based settings, we're referring to all of those types of care. And in your packet, there's a child care market fact sheet that provides a little bit more information if you're interested on that. Family, friends, and neighbor care, as I mentioned, is a form of legal and licensed care. And there's certainly been growing policy interest in this type of provider across the country and in Minnesota in recent years. Last year, we completed a set of studies on family, friends, and neighbor caregivers and the families who use them and learned a lot about this unique kind of provider in the state. We know that the majority of them are grandparents, 52%, and with another 21% being relatives and the remaining 25% being friends and neighbors. Family, friend, and neighbor care can certainly be provided for free by the caregivers, but it's also not uncommon for parents, families to pay for this care or to barter for it in some way. And we estimate that there are approximately 150,000 family, friend, and neighbor caregivers in the state. So turning to the use of child care from the family's perspective, three out of four families use some type of child care on a regular basis in Minnesota. But one important factor to keep in mind is that only about 28% of families use child care on a full-time basis, 35 hours a week or more. And to make the picture even a little more complex, 65% of families are using multiple child care arrangements. So they're typically piecing together, say, a family, friend, and neighbor relationship situation with a center-based arrangement. Among the families who use licensed childcare, 60,000 children enrolled in licensed settings, both centers and family childcare. And then looking at family, friend, and neighbor care, approximately 74% of Minnesota families are using some form of this care, with 46% using it on a regular, as their sole or primary arrangement. We know from studies that we've done that the use of care varies by the age of the child, by family income and other factors, with families with infants and toddlers tending to prefer family, friend, and neighbor care, the more informal type of care, more over center-based settings. But as a child ages into preschool, families often tend to turn to the more formal child care center preschool settings to find the socialization experiences that they're looking for their young children. Looking at what families pay, child care costs are certainly an issue that we pay attention to. And most parents, 70% of Minnesota households using child care, pay something out of pocket for child care. Ranges on an average annual basis from $5,700 a year for an infant or toddler to down to $3,400 for a school-age child. And we know that for lower-income households, they're paying more in proportion to their budgets than higher-income families are. So, for example, a family earning $200,000 or less a year is paying approximately 28% of their budget for child care costs, with families earning over $45,000 paying just 8% of their budget. So how do market-based child care programs support school readiness? This is a question that's important to us because it's one of our primary goals in providing child care quality supports for providers. High-quality programs support school readiness in the same way any other early childhood or early education program does, by providing opportunities for complex play, for socializing with adults and other children, for developing the important physical and language and cognitive skills that they need. We also really recognize that when families have a child care arrangement that works for them, they're able to better succeed in their employment and education plans, and the whole family is more successful. Because we pay attention ensuring that child care supports school readiness, it's important to look at the quality of care in Minnesota. Another recent study that we did in 2005 looked at a random sample of child care centers in the state, and we found that just 25% of them rated good quality on a scale from 1 to 7, so they came in at about a 5. There were certain characteristics of those programs that are important to note. Those that achieved the good quality rating, they tended to have staff with higher levels of education. They were more likely to be accredited by a national accrediting body, and they were more likely to use an intentional curriculum that really focused, provided a framework for understanding child development and thinking about child development. We have less information about the quality of family child care, licensed family child care, and family, friend, and neighbor care. We know that just 1% of licensed family child care providers are accredited, compared to about 19% of child care centers holding accreditation currently. So now I'll quickly turn to the supports for child care quality that we have in place in Minnesota. In your packet, there's a budget page titled Child Care Development Grants, and that is our program area. And I'd first like to cover the federal and state requirements for these quality supports. Our primary federal funding for child care flows to Minnesota in the form of the Child Care Development Fund Black Grant, and states are required to use at least 4% of those dollars to support child care quality. And then there are additional set-asides or funding amounts for supporting quality for infants and toddlers school-age care and child care resource and referral. So on a two-year cycle, we're required to produce a federal plan for the federal government that acts as an agreement between us as a lead agency and the feds, and describes how our CCDF plan will be administered in conformance with legislative requirements and federal regulations issued by the department, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Two points to note in our federal plan that relate to quality that you might be interested in are an initiative started by the Bush Foundation in its first term called Good Start, Grow Smart. And this initiative relates to both Head Start and child care, and it requires or asks states to describe how we are developing and coordinating early learning guidelines for our communities. And early learning guidelines are descriptions of what young children should know and be able to do at different developmental milestones along the way. And Minnesota has such guidelines in the form of a document called the Early Childhood Indicators of Progress, which is also in the packet. The federal plan also asks us to describe our plans for professional development of child care providers. So we inform the federal government of how we both develop and coordinate training and education supports for child care providers. And then in terms of state statutes, we have four primary ones that relate to the child care resource and referral system, loans and grants, and reimbursement for accreditation fees for providers. So how does DHS support child care quality? We have, as Chuck Johnson mentioned, an overall goal of providing information to parents and improving child care quality. We do that through four main strategies that include consumer education about child care quality, and then grants and financial supports for providers, consultation, mentoring, coaching, and technical assistance for providers, and professional development. And throughout all of those areas, we pay attention to school readiness, to training and education opportunities for providers, to how family, friends, and neighbors, caregivers intersect with these strategies, and to ensuring that providers and families from underserved communities are receiving these supports. Our total federal and state funding in fiscal year 06 was $11.2 million. And again, we are asked to use those dollars to support services for all providers, for those 14,000 licensed providers, as well increasingly for family, friend, and neighbor caregivers. But increasingly, we are focusing on providers who are serving higher percentages of children at risk. So to wrap up, just a quick overview of these four strategies. Child care information for parents. The main purpose here is to provide guidance to parents on selecting quality child care. And in doing that, we collect a lot of information about the child care system, and so it's also a good way for us to track trends in child care services. The child care resource and referral system is the primary delivery mechanism for providing information to parents. It's provided both on the phone and online. In 2005, we provided 200,000 referrals in that year, and this information is provided now at no cost to parents, with about 77% of them reporting that it helps them find and locate quality child care. Our funding, both federal and state, for this strategy totals about $1.3 million. In your packet, there's a brochure from the Child Care Resource and Referral System for parents that could give you a lot more information about this service. I'd also just like to note that we'll shortly be rolling out for parents and the public as a whole licensing information on the DHS website, and we see this as kind of a parallel set of information to the Child Care Resource and Referral information. The website will allow anyone to look up the licensing status of a provider and see whether or not it's active and in good standing, or has been denied or is conditional or has been revoked. The second strategy that we work to implement is grants and financial support for providers. Here we're working to provide some resources to providers who often operate at a very low or low profit margin with dollars to improve the quality of their care, scholarships to access education opportunities, and in some cases retention bonuses to retain providers in a field that experiences a lot of high turnover. Again, the resource and referral system is a primary delivery system for these supports, along with other organizations that we provide grants to. And our funding here totals about $3.6 million in federal and almost a half million in state funding. So often providers who are receiving these types of grants are using the dollars to purchase curriculum, to receive training, to make improvements to their facilities, as well as the scholarships and bonuses that I mentioned. The third strategy focuses on consultation and technical assistance to child care providers. Here we're focused on supporting individual practitioners in achieving the skills and knowledge to provide higher quality care. We provide grants to a variety of organizations to provide these services with approximately 200,000 contacts, different types of consultation offered annually for about $1.7 million total. One of the interesting projects that we've been involved in the last few years is called QUINT, which stands for Quality Intervention in Early Care and Education. And this is a federal research project, actually, that's testing the impact of really intensive consultation with family child care providers. A provider is matched up with a consultant over a 10-month period, and they together assess the quality of the child care setting and then set goals on how to improve this quality. And we'll be receiving the results of that project along with results from four other states later in this year. That kind of work is really important to us to better target our dollars and our support. The final strategy that I'd like to provide an overview for you of is our professional development efforts for providers. So like consultation and mentoring, we're here about providing learning opportunities for individual practitioners, often in a classroom setting or online through distance learning opportunities. Again, the Child Care Resource and Referral System is our primary deliverer of training. And we both fund the development of training content, support trainers, and then through the R&R system, coordinate and deliver this training at the local level. You can see that we have worked with, on an annual basis, about 30,000 providers receive this type of support with funding of about $2.7 million, both federal and state. We are in the midst of redesigning our professional development system to more closely tie it to child outcomes and the core competencies that we know that providers need in order to support children's school readiness. So two other documents in your folder, the Early Childhood Indicators of Progress and then the Core Competencies for Minnesota Child Care Practitioners are documents that we really rely on to help us focus the direction of this training. With that, I'm not sure should we do questions at this point?
Yes, thank you. And I think what we'd like to do is, if there are some questions, I'd like to take a couple questions. And I'm always impressed with the depth and breadth of the programs that you run and what there is happening with Department of Human Services in terms of child care. Members, are there any questions? Representative Murphy?
Just Just one question about the funding of the four strategies. There's a lot of federal money and proportionately less state money, and I'm wondering with the federal money if there's a requirement for match, and if you could talk a little bit about the stability of funding from the feds.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, at this point in time, I think we predict funding that would remain stable from the federal level, and you're right, that is the majority of our funding. The entire child care development fund does require, as it flows to the states, a match from the states. Perhaps Sheree Katilda could speak better to that, as I am not as familiar with that part of the funding. But again, child care quality is required to receive at least 4% of the total funding for Minnesota.
Senator, Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 3 of the PowerPoint here. Mm-hmm. Well, you're talking about quality in the child care setting, and you mentioned a recent study dealing with quality.
Mm-hmm.
Who did the study?
Madam Chair, Representative Nornes, the study was conducted through a project that was funded by the Child Care Bureau in the federal U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and that project provided the opportunity for a partnership in Minnesota of state agencies and researchers. The project name was the Minnesota Child Care Policy Research Partnership. So under that partnership, which has the funding for which has ended, one of the partnering research organizations, Child Trends, carried out that study. And they're a Washington-based organization that actually has staff in Minnesota, and they were the primary authors of the study. DHS was the lead organization in the partnership, and so produced the report that you can find online on our website.
Representative Norris?
And how recent was that, did you say?
Madam Chair, Representative 2005.
Representative Norris?
Madam Chair, I guess I find that a little bit disturbing that as it doesn't look good. If only 25% are good, then what are the other 75? And that's what concerned me when I saw that, and I wasn't sure if I could believe that or trust that. So,
Ms. Swenson-Klein?
Madam Chair, Representative, the study used a observational tool to assess quality that's been used in a number of studies around the country and internationally as well. The tool is called the Early Childhood Environmental Rating Scale, and it's research-based. It's been used. It was developed by the University of North Carolina, and covers kind of the whole set of quality domains that researchers understand are important to the quality of care. There is no question that there are some. That the instrument is not a perfect instrument. It's challenging, in particular, for child care centers, any early childhood setting, to achieve quality in some of the domains that are studied. And there's a lot of rigor involved. And to be honest, debate among child care researchers about how much emphasis to place on one area of quality versus another. One of the places where Minnesota child care centers scored lower was in the area of health and safety, and in particular, practices around hand washing and diapering, very stringent standards are set in the tool for those practices, and I think they're important because they do keep children healthy and safe if those practices are implemented. I think that on the good news in that is that it's relatively easy for a program to improve its practices in those areas. It doesn't cost a lot of money to improve your hand washing practices, but it does take paying attention to that type of practice on an ongoing basis. Where programs scored better in Minnesota is in an area like adult-child interaction and the relationships that adults have with children. And again, that we thought that that was good news. And so I think one of the useful pieces of this of using a tool like that is really digging in and understanding what it says about a particular program. And then understanding what we can really draw from it when we're aggregating the data. So I think it shows that there's lots of room for improvement for Minnesota centers, and it highlights both some strengths and weaknesses across the state.
Representative Norman?
One more comment, I guess. I just find it hard to believe that we don't have at least one or two that rate higher than good.
Madam Chair, Representative, that in the following the use of this tool, the numbers scoring excellent were very low out of the 100 centers that were rated.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Swenson-Clad. We have one more question here from Representative Ward, and then we are going to move on to Katie Williams if she wants to come down. I think we're going to have you go in the middle here, because then we'll finish up with the department. And I want to say, Representative Norman said, this is a very good question, and that is something I think we all try to figure out is when we hear research, if it's biased or not, and where it comes from, and what the organization is that's doing the research. So I think we all need to keep an eye on that in our various committees. Representative Ward?
Madam Chair, Ms. Swenson-Clack, thank you. My question regards the same study, and you made reference to it. You said that 100 child care centers were researched, and how many centers are there in Minnesota, and who decided which ones were going to be evaluated?
Madam Chair, Representative, the sample for the study did include 100 centers randomly selected across the state, and there are approximately 900 child care centers in the state. So, again, the study chose a set of randomly selected programs for inclusion.
Representative Ward, okay. We have one quick one from Representative Peterson, and Ms. Williams, if you could come down. Representative Peterson?
Well, I was just looking at the statistics. You've got half of the children in the state in the FN settings, and it says in here that they are not accredited. Only 1% are accredited. Do we have? And obviously, they must. You know, there's some state or federal monies involved with even those programs. Is there any evaluation of any of those programs?
Madam Chair, Representative, the 1% figure refers to licensed family child care homes in the state, which are different from family, friend, and neighbor legally unlicensed programs. I think that the low percentage of accreditation of family child care, licensed family child care homes reflects just a lack of recognition among family child care providers that that's a resource that they can use to demonstrate their quality. We have some other ways of looking at the quality of family child care homes, particularly the education level of the provider, because, again, we know that higher levels of training and education do contribute to higher quality. But in general, I agree that that's an area where that deserves some more attention, a study potentially that looks at the quality of family child care settings in Minnesota would provide valuable information for the state.
Thank you, Ms. Swenson-Clad. And if there's questions afterwards on the overall program, we may call you back up. So thank you. Next we have Katie Williams, who is the Director of the Early Childhood Programs for the Minneapolis YWCA. Welcome to the committee, if you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Katie Williams, and I'm Director of Early Childhood Programs at the YWCA of Minneapolis. And I feel a little like Prasanna, who barged into my office today and said the four words that she knows, or at least the ones she knew today, which were party, birthday, boo, cake. And that told me her whole story. She turned two today. So here I am. We have four child care centers in Minneapolis, and we provide full-time care for over 400 children every day, infants through school age. And it's our mission and goal to provide effective early childhood care and education for those most at risk of not being ready for school and those least able to access quality care. So that is families with low income, children of color, and recent immigrants. 85% of our children are children of color. 72% of our families are low income. 67% are on the child care assistance program that you're going to hear about from Cherie next. And 66% of our families are headed by a single parent, most of them women, but not all. Our goal is to nurture children in partnership with their parents and prepare them for success in school. Our programs are nationally accredited and meet the standards that make the difference in providing quality early childhood care and education. Our adult child ratios, our teacher qualifications, our educational curriculum, and our support services all exceed the minimum state licensing requirements. Many of our children come to us looking very unlikely to be ready for school. Their initial screen often shows serious delays in key developmental areas of language, cognitive, social, emotional, behavioral, or physical skills. Some of them are already identified as being special needs children with serious diagnosed difficulties, but most are not. Most are just delayed for various reasons. Mostly because of what they haven't gotten as input thus far in their lives. Yet when they graduate, our children, when they graduate and leave us, over 90% of them test ready for kindergarten. In 2005, it was 98%. We're very proud of that. It seems as though our staff are working miracles, and I see them happening every day, but they really aren't miracles. Our staff are just providing high-quality early childhood education and care and intervention. We do this at an average cost of about $14,000 per year per child. Here's some of the keys to the quality of our programs. First of all, primary caregiving means every child who comes to us is assigned to one of the teachers in their class, and they are part of that teacher's small group, and that teacher pays special attention to them every day and provides the bulk of their care, feeds them if they're an infant, rocks them to sleep, changes their diapers, plays with them, talks to them, sings to them, and writes a note home to the parents every day about how that child's day went. As they get older, for instance, in an infant classroom, it's three children for every teacher. In a toddler classroom, the teachers have a small group of five, and in the preschool, it's seven or eight children. As they get older, the teachers continue to track on their care, eats meals with them, helps the toddlers with their diaper and toilet training, helps the preschoolers with their special learning activities, and communicates with the parents. It means the parents know that someone is really tracking on their child, and even if their child is not causing any problems at all, someone's paying special attention to them every day. Then we also have special needs coordinators in each of our centers. These are people with special training who screen each child within their first month with us and then track on whether they need intervention and if so what, and follow that up, work with the teachers and the parents to develop a special individual education plan for each child and follow through with that. Each center has a family services coordinator who works closely with parents. They identify resources needed to strengthen the family's ability to support their child's education. Some of our families are in real crisis, and what they need is access to very basic resources like a shelter or food or a place to live. Others are ready to engage more in their child's education, and that's our goal, to involve them They set goals together for each family for involvement in their child's learning. We have our own curriculum that's based on early literacy and developmentally appropriate pre-math, science, language, physical, social, emotional standards, and is aligned with the state's early childhood guidelines. Our staff are well qualified, and we provide training for them throughout the year to upgrade their skills. We provide good wages and excellent benefits to support our staff. No wonder we get good results, and we are certainly not the only programs in Minnesota to be doing this. I have to say, though, that for the last few years, our job has been made very much more difficult by the lack of state support for these children. We and other quality centers, like ours, have had to cut corners and reduce quality, lose good staff, and consider closing classrooms. Our agency had to raise over $800,000 in 2006 alone to help us keep serving low-income families. Many of our low-income families qualify for CCAP, the Child Care Assistance Program, but their incomes are just above the low entry level, so they can't get that assistance. Many of them are eligible for CCAP and even for the entry level, but are on long waiting lists and are waiting for help. We provide scholarships to absolutely as many families as we can, but we still have to turn many, many away. The reimbursement rate we're paid per child for children on CCAP was frozen in 2003, and it increased slightly last year. But as our costs rise, the rates do not, because they are still frozen, and that makes it increasingly difficult. Our CCAP parent co-payments are still too high for low-income families. Some of our families can't make those assigned co-payments, and we need to give them additional scholarships to lower those. Many of them are able to pay the co-payment if it's 10% of their income, but if it's 20% of their income, they can't do that. The 25-day absence policy that you'll hear more about at some point, I'm sure, has been quite a nightmare for us, and we still need a half-day rate for schoolagers who are paid for hourly. So those are some of our challenges, and we're very grateful to you all for being on this committee, for caring about early childhood care and education. Let me just close by saying we're committed to serving the children who are most at risk of not being ready for kindergarten, and we know how to do it. We know we can make the difference for them because we've done it over and over. But we can't keep losing more and more money, and we won't keep cutting quality. We think Minnesota needs our programs and all the others like ours, but we and our families need some more help. Thank you.
Thank you. And I recently had the opportunity to tour the Minneapolis YWCA program, and they're doing a great job serving kids, but have definitely suffered from the cuts. So thank you for your testimony. We're going to take questions for about 10 minutes. We have three members on the list. We have Representative Wardlow, Representative Murphy, and Representative Garofalo. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question. Have you been around doing this long enough so that you can do a longitudinal study? Because you said that, like in 2005, 98% were kindergarten ready. Have you been able to study and track those kids to see how they continue to do? I guess I'm thinking of the achievement gap. Are they closing the achievement gap, the kids that are in this 98% group or like them?
Ms. Williams?
Madam Chair and Representative Wardlow, we don't have a longitudinal study. We have anecdotal evidence, both from families. Many of our families have a number of children with us, and so they report back to us. We also hear from teachers in the school system that they go to, that they came well prepared and did well in kindergarten and moved through the system. But we don't have an anecdotal, a long-range longitudinal study, although we have been working with Hennepin County. They are able to get information from the schools that we can't about, they can give a list of children and get results. So they are working on tracking that.
Representative Wardlow?
I was wondering how old, what's the highest grade you've seen or heard anecdotal data? I mean, like, I know they say they did well in kindergarten. Have you heard from parents who said my kid's in eighth grade now, and he's still doing great. You know,
Ms. Williams, that represented. Yes, indeed, we have children. We know children, and I've been there over 20 years, so I know children who come back and have done wonderfully all the way through school. We've even had some come back to work with us, and others report back at how well they did. So yes, we have indeed heard anecdotally.
Representative Murphy, and I realize there's two Representative Murphys here, so I think it's Representative Murphy M.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, Williams. We have four child care centers providing full-time care for over 400 children every day. What hours do those children come?
Yes.
7 days a week?
Ms. Williams?
No, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. 5 days a week, we open at 7 in the morning and we close at 6 in the evening. And the children come at some point. Most of them are there all day. Some are there right at 7 and leave at 5, or some come by 8:30 and are there till 6. Depends on their parents' work schedules.
Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, Ms. Williams, is there any program for child care on weekends?
Ms. Williams?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. No, we do not have a weekend child care program.
Or night,
no.
And then, Madam Chair, Ms. Williams, the 25-day absence policy, I don't know about that.
Ms. Williams?
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. There's a policy that went into effect that if children are absent more than 25 days in a year, subsequent absences are not paid for through the child care assistance program. And this has meant that we need to keep track of that, and our billing needs to be adjusted. And each child has reasons why they were absent and whether they were absent. So it's been very complicated bookkeeping for us. Our experience is that there is also part of the absence day policy that if a child is absent more than 10 days in a row, they will lose their coverage unless the child care worker has some reason to reinstate it. But we have found that some children are absent for a variety of reasons. Some is illness. Some is because someone else in their family is ill and mom doesn't want to drag them all out to take one child. Some is because mom might have a week off from school or a chance to send the child to visit a grandparent. But all of that counts against them and makes it difficult for us since we're having to provide the program every day whether the child comes or not. What we do is if a child has what we consider excessive absences, we talk to the parent and say, you know, you're not making the best use of this child care program. Your child isn't getting the benefit of it and learning, so maybe you need a different kind of program.
Thank you. Okay, we have Representative Garofalo, Representative Eastland, Winkler, and Gottwalt, and we still have one more testifier, so if you can try to make them brief, I appreciate it. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the testifier, based on your comments, is it your opinion that we should remove the absence day policy?
Madam Chair, and Representative Blossom, yes. We would like to see the absence day policy removed. I think that it was working before, and perhaps there need to be the child care workers need to have some way of tightening up on families that have excessive absences. But it would be we think it worked before, and we would like to get rid of it. At the very least, we would like to be paid partial rate for those excessive absences.
Representative Groffel?
Madam Chair, is the testifier aware that under current law you brought up the condition of a child being sick, but if there is medical documentation, those absences don't count against the 25-day limit?
Yes.
Ms. Williams?
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, we are aware of that, but many of our children are absent a day here, a day there, with a cold, with a flu, someone else in the family has a cold or the flu, and so it's not easy for them to be constantly trying to get that medical documentation. If there's a child who's out with strep throat or chickenpox or something that's diagnosed and is some length, then it is easy for them.
Madam Chair, testifier, in your comments you state that many of our low-income families qualify for CCAP, but their incomes are just above the 175% poverty guideline entry bar. Do you, I assume you would like to see that percentage increase. Do you have a recommended percentage for the committee that you'd like to see it at?
Ms. Williams?
Madam Chair, Representative, we would like to see it, first of all, go back to being tied to state median income rather than federal poverty guidelines. We think that fits Minnesota better. And we would like to see the entry level be the same as the exit level so that they don't have to get in under a low bar, but anyone who is eligible for the program income-wise could get onto the program.
Madam Chair and the testifier, 250%, that's the exit level, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And last question, Madam Chair and the testifier. And number four, you state that the CCAP parent co-pays are still too high for low-income families. And again, I'm wondering if you could offer your suggestion on what you would like to see for co-payment levels.
Ms. Williams?
Madam Chair and Representative, 10% or less of a family's income, some of the very, very lowest income families can't even manage that 10%, but not higher than 10%.
Okay, so I lied. One more question, sir.
Representative Rothwell.
Madam Chair and the testifier, so that, again, up to the 250% level, a co-payment level of 10% of the payment or 10% of the person's income?
Ms. Williams?
Madam Chair, Representative, we're talking about 10% of their income so that they're not paying more than 10% of their income for child care, which is still quite a bite.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Eastland.
I'm respecting the time.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Ms. Williams, I'd like to first observe that a $14,000 annual cost per child is fairly good. I have a two-month-old and a two-year-old at home, and when my wife goes off maternity leave, we are looking at various options, but we certainly would be paying more at a high-quality center for the same kinds, I mean, for child care for two children, and per child would be paying more than that, and we're not dealing with the same kinds of challenges that you're facing. So first I would say congratulations for getting good results for the money being spent. The second is kind of two related questions. You can address them both at the same time. How do the kids find you? How do you reach out to families? How do families become aware of what you're offering? And is it your perception that it's families who are best able to find good resources, or is it or is it only those families who are best able to take advantage of what's offered to them that are coming to you, or is it a cross section of all kids who may be at risk?
Ms. Williams,
Madam Chair and Representative, families, our very best way for families to find us is through word of mouth because other people tell them they like our program. Families use the resource and referral network to get information about us. Many, many families that come to us are on the Diversionary Work Program or on MFIP, and their counselors give them information about programs. The preschool screening gives information about programs like ours that can provide some extra for children who seem to be behind. And then our programs are pretty well located that people see them and know that they're there. So those are probably our best sources.
Madam Chair, one.
Representative Winkler.
Ms. Williams, if you were to receive additional funding to enlarge your programming, how are you capable of scaling, or would some, larger size create more difficulties than you're currently dealing with?
Ms. Williams.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler. We just opened a new program this last year, and that's our preference, is not to make one program be larger, but open additional programs. And we don't see our mission as trying to solve all the child care needs in the city. It's essential to us that we keep the quality of our programs high. We'll probably continue to expand one center at a time over the years, but in my experience anyway, opening a new one every 5 years is about all we can manage. We'd much rather provide additional support to improve the quality at other centers.
Okay, thank you. We're going to have our last question from Representative Gottwald. Did I get it right?
You did.
Okay, and then we'll ask Sheree Kiltilnik if you could start to come down and take your place at the table. I sure appreciate it. Representative Gutwall?
Madam Chair and Testifier, Ms. Williams, first of all, congratulations. I think you're achieving excellent outcomes, and we want to focus on achieving outcomes. I think that's the most important thing of all. I notice in your brochure you mentioned in partnership with families, and we know the research shows that parental involvement and engagement is such a critical factor for the success of young children and older children. What do you do to work with the families? How do you connect with the parents in caring for the kids?
Ms. Williams?
Madam Chair and Representative Gutwall. Each family that comes to us meets not only with the teacher who's going to care for their child, but also, of course, the manager of the program and also our family services coordinator who talks with them about what their needs are, what their challenges are, what their interests are. And depending on the needs and interests that they identify, they set what we call family engagement goals. And they continue to work with the teacher, classroom teacher, and the family services coordinator on those goals. And they really vary because families are at all different levels. But, of course, our hope is to get them very much involved in our program, in what the children are doing every day and in carrying out activities at home that will reinforce what the children are doing at the center. We want them to come frequently for conferences so that we can report the child's progress, so we can suggest additional activities they can do at home. We also want them to come to our family activities because many of them are in need of a support group, a community, and they can provide that for one another and support one another in improving the way that they're involved with their children as they grow.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Williams. We appreciate you talking about your program and letting us know about how the child care assistance works in conjunction with that. Next, we have Sheree Kiltilnik, who's the manager of child care assistance programs for the Department of Human Services. Members, the objective today is just to have an overview of these programs. As we get into the governor's budget next week, we'll have much more detail on the numbers, and you can start to compare numbers over the last couple years. On Thursday, just to remind you, we have the research aspect being presented, and it's going to be Art Rolnick from the Federal Reserve Board and Arthur Reynolds from the University of Minnesota. So I think it's going to be really good, especially in terms of how to close the achievement gap. So with that, and I know some of you, with this being a 5:30 committee, might need to leave early, but I'm hoping you'll stick around and hear what Ms. Kiltilnik has to say. I also encourage you, if you have questions, to meet with her outside of the hearing and to get any information you might need. Ms. Kiltilnik.
Madam Chair, my name is Sheree Kiltilnik, and I'm the manager of the Child Care Assistance Program with the Department of Human Services. It's my pleasure to be here with you in this committee again. I believe that you and I started with the legislature together. In your freshman year was the first year that I started working with the legislature also.
That's right.
And we're both still in early childhood.
1997, yes.
Yeah. I want to give you a quick overview of the Child Care Assistance Program. It is a very complicated program, and there are lots of details that we'll uncover as time goes by, but I want to give you a quick overview today. I brought lots of supporting documents so that you can look at those at your leisure, and I'll refer to some of them during the presentation, and then I also want to allow some time for questions. The left-hand side of your folder has some of the documents that I brought with, and I just want to walk through those quickly. And they're in different colors. Hopefully that will help us stay a little more awake for the last half an hour of this presentation late in the day. The first one that you have is the Child Care Assistance Facts and Figures. It's a document that we do every year, and we put up on the DHS website. So you'll have it in your packet here. This is the 06 version. It's the most current version, and you can find that on the DHS website also. The next document you have is bright blue, and this is not the most current document. This is a sample of the family profile that we do every year, which gives the characteristics of all the families on the MFIP and Basic Sliding Fee Child Care Program. This is the document for 2005. We're nearly ready to release the 2006 document. That also will be on the DHS website, so it'll be up there probably early February. The next document that you have is purple. And that is the October waiting list, the Basic Sliding Fee Program. So that's the most current waiting list that we have up to date right now. This also goes up on the web. Every time we have a more current month, you'll see it on the web. And I will give you the web address for that. The next document that you have is a copy of the Child Care Assistance Program Forecast.
This is the amount of money that has been spent on or is projected to be spent on the child care assistance program starting with 1999 and going through 2011. And it's broken down by federal and state and county shares, and it has the average cost per family, and it has the monthly average number of families by sub-program. This, I believe, is on the Department of Finance website, but it's with a whole bunch of other documents, and this is all by itself here for you today. One side of this of the forecast page tells you how much we project to spend in total for child care, and then the other side tells you how much we're spending for direct services. The total includes the admin that we send to the counties to administer the program, the admin reimbursement. The next document that we have is pink, and this is not on any website anywhere, but it is just for your information. As people referred to today in some of the other testimony, there were a lot of changes in the child care program since 2003. The front side of the pink page talks about the changes that were done in 2003 and the more restrictive policies that were put in place. On the back of that page, you will see 2004, 2005, and 2006. And those were session highlights where things were tweaked, reinstated, changed, and added back into the program. So those are the highlights of the changes since 2003, so you can kind of see where we're at with the child care assistance program. The bright pink piece of paper that you have is the web addresses for all the things that I told you you could find on the website. In addition to the things that I brought with us today, we also have all of our bulletins on the website. And so you'll find things like all of the child care rates, the maximum payment rates in the child care assistance program. You'll find things like the co-payment schedules for all family sizes. And you'll find all of the policy changes that have happened in the last year on the website. I also gave you the web address for the child care assistance program statute and rule so that you can look at those whenever you want to. In your packet, you also have the budget pages for the MSIS Child Care Assistance Program and for the Basic Sliding Fee Child Care Assistance Program. So I'm going to refer you back to some of those documents during the presentation, but I wanted to let you know what you have there. I did mention that the Child Care Assistance Program is governed by the Child Care and Development Fund and by state rule and state statute. The Child Care Development Fund is our federal source of money for this program. There was a question earlier when Deb was talking about the state match requirements for the Child Care and Development Fund, and the match is right now at about $27.8 million, and the maintenance of effort requirement is at $19.6 million. The state money that's invested in the Child Care Assistance Program more than meets the match and the MOE requirements. The funds that we spend, in addition to those that are required for match and MOE for the Child Care and Development Fund, are used to draw down TANF money. In accordance with the guidelines for the Child Care and Development Fund and with state statute, the Child Care Assistance Program is designed to serve several purposes. One is to help make child care affordable for low-income families. I should do this. There. Child care is affordable for low-income families. Another goal of the program is to allow parents to work or attend school, and the other low-income parents to work or attend school, and the other is to support the idea that children are well cared for and ready to learn. The Child Care Assistance Program eligibility guidelines are based on the parent's activity and income. This is important to know because sometimes this does get in the way of the child's continuity of care and the providers that parents are able to choose for their children. The authorized activities of the parent, so the parent's work schedule, the parent's school schedule, things like that, determine how much and when care can be authorized and whether there are interruptions in care with a single caregiver for the child. The kind of activities that are allowed are working, looking for work, school in some circumstances, and other activities that can be authorized in the MSIP or the DWP employment plan. The income eligibility for the Child Care Assistance Program was referred to earlier. That's, the entry is at 175 of the Federal Poverty Guidelines, and it's the exit is at 250% of the poverty guidelines. For a family of three, 175 of FPG is $28,158, and for the exit level, it would be $40,225. On average, child care assistance program families are very low income. If you and in 06, 60% of the basic sliding fee families have incomes below 150% of poverty guidelines. 90% of the basic sliding fee families have incomes below 200% of the poverty guidelines. And 100% of the MFIP families have incomes below approximately 80% of the federal poverty guidelines. So the families on the child care assistance are the very low-income families in the state. The family profile, which I referred to you to earlier, includes that kind of information on page 4. And in the family profile, one of the things that I wanted to point out is that whenever possible, we've been tracking this information since 1996, and whenever possible, we give you a series of 3 or 4 years of information so you can compare how things are changing over time. When you look at the estimated income by poverty level, you'll see that it has gone down significantly over time. The percentage of families at low income have gone up. The co-payments for the families in the child care assistance program start at 75% of federal poverty guidelines, and they are $10 per family per month. They gradually increase from that point to the exit level at 250%, and at that point, parents are paying 18% of their gross income for their co-payments. For a family of three, that would be approximately $287 a month. Parents in the child care assistance program must use a legal provider. Deb Swinson-Klatt mentioned to you who the legal providers are in Minnesota. It's licensed child care centers, licensed family child care homes, school-age programs that are operated through the school districts, family, friends, and neighbor care. One of the differences in the child care assistance program is that if a parent chooses a family, friend, and neighbor provider, that provider has to pass a background check and a child protection record check. That's different than any requirements that exist for any family, friend, and neighbor caregiver in the private market. But in the child care assistance program, we do have background checks for family, friends, and neighbor. All families in the child care assistance program must cooperate with child support enforcement if they are a single parent. And the eligible children must be 12 years old or younger. In some circumstances, we can serve kids who are up to age 14 if they have special needs or are handicapped. The family profile also gives you the percentage of kids in each age range on the child care assistance program. So if you want to see how many are 0 to 1, 2 to 4, that kind of stuff, it's on the family profile for you. Families who participate in the child care assistance program have to choose providers that operate in the private market. Deb talked to you a little bit about how big the private market is. To give you a sense of how small we are as purchasers in the private market, we did an analysis of our purchasing capacity in 2004. And that licensing the analysis that we did with licensing data suggested that approximately 6% of licensed family child care slots and 10% of licensed center slots are filled with children funded at least in part by CCAP. Some child care programs care for a much higher percentage of CCAP kids, but on average, 6 and 10% of the slots in the state are filled with child care assistance program children. Payment rates. This has been a source of continuous controversy since 2003. The rates of all licensed providers are surveyed at least once every 2 years, and currently the Department of Human Services surveys those annually. So the federal government requires us to do it at least once every 2 years, but the Department of Human Services does do this rate survey annually. Prior to 2003, the annual market rate survey was used to set the caps on the child care assistance program rates. In 2003, when you look at your child care assistance program change sheet, your light pink sheet, you'll see that the rates were frozen at the level of the survey in 2001. After that time, there were some tweaks. In the next year, some of the rates were increased to 100 percentile of 2002. And then a little bit later, there was an increase of 1.75% or the market rate, whichever was lower. And then there was an increase in this last session of 6% in the market rates. They still are raised in relation to the 2001 and 2002 rates. So the current market rate surveys that we are doing are generally giving us an indication of the market and our payment rates in relation to the market, but they're not actually being used to set the rates in the program currently. Child care payments may not exceed the maximum rate parameters that are identified in statute. The child care assistance program will pay 100% of a provider's rate less the co-payment up to the maximum rate. If the provider is accredited, we also allow an accreditation differential, so we'll pay up to 15% more than the maximum rates that are identified in the rate bulletin. If a provider charges more than the CCAP maximum payment that's allowed, the parent's responsible for the difference. One of the measures that we use of our compliance with federal guidelines around rates is looking at our rates in relation to the private market and determining what level of access we're allowing for child care for the child care assistance program participants. The family profile also tracks that on an annual basis, and on the last page of the family profile, the very back page, you'll see that we have the percentage of providers covered by maximum rates. In 06, the numbers are 65% of the family child care providers and 54.5% of the child care centers in the state are covered by the CCAP maximum rates. We also are now using these access numbers as a measure of our performance on the budget page. So you'll see that on the budget page. The child care assistance program is, we call it one big program, but it actually consists of three sub-programs. The MFIP child care program has two sub-programs. One is for families who are participating in MFIP or DWP, so those are the families that are on Minnesota's cash assistance program. And another is the transition year program, and that program is for families who were on MFIP or DWP and have now worked their way off of MFIP or DWP. That's available for families for up to a year after they leave the cash assistance program. If there's a waiting list in their county and they would not be able to get onto basic sliding fee at the end of their 1 year, we now have a transition year extension, which allows them to stay in transition year for as long as necessary to get onto the basic sliding fee program. The basic sliding fee is the other program, the other child care program for the non-cash assistance families, the working families that come off the street. Basic sliding fee is a capped allocation. The MFIP child care program, which includes MFIP and transition year, is a fully funded forecasted program. So when you hear about the waiting lists in our purple sheet that we have here, the waiting lists apply to the basic sliding fee program. The basic sliding fee program also includes the at-home infant care program. And I don't know if any of you are aware of that, but that's a program that is designed to allow families with infants to stay home for up to 12 months with their infant and to get a portion of what they would have gotten for their child care assistance program subsidy during that time. When the basic sliding fee program has a waiting list, there are priorities for getting back to for your name, getting on to the basic sliding fee program. The priorities are, the first priority is families without a high school diploma or GED, and the youngest families first. Those families would not get service if they were on the waiting list waiting for basic sliding fee. The next priority is families who are completing their transition year of child care assistance. Those families would be getting service while they're waiting to get on basic sliding fee. The next priority is families who are participating in the portability pool. The portability pool in the basic sliding fee program is a state set-aside that allows families who move between counties to get service for up to 6 months through the state set-aside if there's a waiting list in the county that they move to. Generally, those families who are on the waiting list are getting child care assistance while they're on the waiting list. The remaining priorities are families where there's at least one parent who is a veteran, and then all other families on the program. And those families would not be getting service while they're waiting on the waiting list. In closing, I just want to talk a little bit about the size of the child care assistance program. In state fiscal year 06, the expenditure and caseload for the child care assistance program, we served a monthly average of 16,700 families and a monthly average of almost 30,000 children for $171 million approximately. So it's a big investment. It's really the single biggest source of early childhood funding that the state has control of in Minnesota, and it serves 30,000 low-income kids on average every year. The projected funding in 07 is $202 million, and your forecast page will tell you how that's divided among the programs. The children in the child care assistance program are generally in care full-time. The families have to be working full-time, and when we're paying for child care, we're generally paying for approximately 35 or more hours of care per week. And that's the end of my presentation, unless you have questions.
Well, thank you. I hope there's some questions. I would say you did a very good job of finishing that with a few minutes to go. This is a very complicated program, members, but realize you will be seeing this over and over, and we'll be discussing it through various bills. Are there any questions? Representative Murphy? Or how about we start with Representative Eastland?
I just have a question on the waiting list. I would look at the purple, this purple sheet here. Mm-hmm. How does the waiting list work? Are the allocations given by county up front so that waiting lists occur in some counties and they don't occur in other counties, or does that just mean there aren't any requests in some counties? I mean, I guess, how does the waiting list work?
Ms. Melton?
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, the allocation formula for the Child Care Assistance Program is in statute, and it's, let me see if I can recall it for you. 90% of the money is allocated based on the previous year's expenditures, and then the remaining 10% is allocated based on the waiting list numbers in order to try to get the funds that are available to the counties that have waiting lists and have higher demand. In some cases, there are counties who have more funds than they need for the families that are asking for service. In some cases, there are, in many cases, 36 counties, there are not sufficient funds to serve all the families who need assistance. We have started a new process to help. When there are unexpended funds in the child care assistance program, they can be reallocated to counties that have overexpended. In order to help counties identify whether it's in their best interest to overexpend and possibly get that funding reimbursed, we started tracking expenditures for all counties and calculating and projecting encumbrances for the rest of the year on a statewide basis so that each county can look at what's happening in other counties and determine whether or not if they invested county funds, there's a likelihood that they would get some back so that we can try to get closer to spending the full amount in places where it's most needed.
Representative Eastland?
Madam Chair, yeah. I mean, I was on the Early Childhood Committee back in 2002, and I remember this was an issue then. It's just like we had waiting lists, but we had funds that were not being used. It's kind of a hard animal to get your arms around. I guess it's the question, and maybe that would be something we should look at trying to figure out how to get the resources of the people that need it.
Yeah. Ms. Katelnik?
Madam Chair and Representative Eastland, we actually do have a work group with county participants working with us right now on analyzing the allocation formula and potentially making recommendations for changes. So we will have the report of that work group shortly. I need to say that at this point in time, it doesn't look like they have any significant changes that they can propose that would, you know, make it significantly better.
Representative Eastland, Ms. Katelnik, I mean, I think part of it is all of us trying to understand it. I know my county, which is a major metropolitan county, is zero as well. So, but I think they use other funding methods to get to the waiting list. But we can go into this further. I was going to try to get Representative Murphy and Representative Peterson, and then we will try to end on time. Representative Murphy. Okay, thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just to follow up on Representative Eason's comments. I noticed Hennepin County has a large number of on the waiting list, but Ramsey, none. And I'm wondering why that differential. It seems to me they have the same populations, and why that difference?
Ms. Katelnik?
Madam Chair, I cannot guess why Ramsey has none. if I were to guess anything, I would say that they probably had projected their expenditures are a little higher than they thought they would be, and they came to a point where they realized that they had more money to spend than they thought, so they pulled the families off the waiting list. But, I mean, that's truly a guess.
Ms. Kasilnik, is there a way we could have someone from Ramsey County follow up with the committee about maybe the comparison of Hennepin and Ramsey and why, at least for Ramsey, I'm sure that's all they can answer for, why the number might be zero, and if they can get back to us on email or through a memo, I think it would be interesting for us to learn, you know, how the different counties are handling it.
Thank you.
We have 2 minutes. Is there any last questions? Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, this is not a question for the testifier. Actually, it's a request to the committee fiscal staff. Mm-hmm. In our last meeting, we had a handout on House Finance Division accounts, and there were six of them listed, three for DHS and three for Department of Education. And maybe this was presented, but I'm looking for a ballpark total of all six of those accounts from the last biennium, and maybe prior to that. If you have it now, you know, ballpark would be fine, or more information.
Well, we have our brand new fiscal analyst, and
welcome to the committee.
She's able to answer that. Do you have that answer, or can you get that answer for us?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, you're asking for the prior biennium, the 2006 and 7, the total state, like the general fund appropriations that for all just DHS or DHS plus the Department of Ed?
And Madam Chair, for Department of Education and Department of Human Services, all told. As I read this handout from last week, there were six division accounts that make up our committee oversight and budget, and so I'm wondering what the total dollar figure.
Representative Winkler, I think that's a good question. We can talk about exactly how to sort of slice and dice that, but in other words, how much is this committee going to have to spend? Right, and I think that's a good question.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I'm understanding your question right, I think in the last biennium it was just under $310 million for total spending, which sounds, you know, compared to, but that's not taking into account federal spending, TANF funds like she was talking about, so we can get more into the, I think we should get more into the numbers.
Thank you.
To make it clear for everyone.
But we'll get that information as well as the financial information will start to roll out here as the proposals get on the table. So with that, members, we are adjourned.